This is The Far Middle. I'm Nick DeOlias. It's late summer and it's mid-August, and those things, they get me thinking about baseball. And as baseball season winds down and the second part of the season coming into playoffs and the World Series, which brings us to the episode 65 dedication. Episode 65, we're going to tie this one to 65 games and 65 World Series games to be specific, because that's a number of Fall Classic games that the great Mickey Mantle played in during his stellar career. He's second in games career for World Series behind that of Yogi Berra. And now when you play right in that many Fall Classic games, 65 total, you've got a chance to set a couple of records. And Mantle did just that in his 65 games. So he's got the World Series career records for most runs. He's got the record for most RBIs in a World Series career. And he's also got the record for the most World Series walks. But his most impressive, and I think his most unbreakable record when it comes to career World Series accomplishment, that's Mickey Mantle's 18 home runs. So Babe Ruth, just to put this in comparison, Mantle hit 18 home runs in 65 World Series games. 18 home runs is a record for career in a World Series. Babe Ruth, he's number two at 15. Yogi Berra, again, Mantle's teammate for a significant period of time, he's third at 12 home runs over his World Series career. Duke Snider's 11. Reggie Jackson, Mr. October, and Lou Gehrig, they're both sitting at 10. So none of these individuals that I just mentioned, including Mantle, none of the top 10 actually, are from the mid-80s or after. And I think that reflects that dynasties, you had them back then, prior to really free agency taking charge of things. And when you had those dynasties, it allowed great players like Mantle to appear in scores of World Series year after year. They would rack up the games, and then they would rack up things like the 18 home runs. So I don't think we'll see Mantle's 18 home runs in 65 World Series games for a career broken. I think that's one of those unbreakable records. By the way, Mantle also holds another World Series career record that I didn't mention, and that's the record for strikeouts. Nothing ventured, nothing gained, right? That's true in baseball, that's true in business, and that is true in life. So episode 65, it's dedicated to the 65 World Series career games, the 18 home runs that went with them, and the great Mickey Mantle from Commerce, Oklahoma, the Commerce Comet. So let's get rolling with the connections. You got Mantle. He played in 65 World Series games. In that process, he accumulated 18 home runs. Well, we've posted now 65 episodes of the Far Middle podcast. And in the process, we weren't accumulating home runs on the baseball diamond, but we were accumulating questions for and from the constant listeners. So we're going to invest the time for this episode of The Far Middle to answering questions that have rolled in from those constant listeners. And I get these from all places and directions. I've got them from coworkers, across email, social media messages, and also just out there on the street. In fact, the majority of these questions, they come from people that I run into by chance who mention that they listen, and then they'll say something like, hey, you know, what about this, or discussing that on your next episode. So I've been saving them up in the virtual mailbag, so to speak, and we can cover a few of them this episode, because I think many of them are very timely and they're important sitting here in the summer of 2022. I'm going to start with perhaps the first question that I ever received, which is, how do I choose the topics each week for the Far Middle? And look, I'd like to tell you, it's a highly scientific method that utilizes the best in artificial intelligence and machine learning, along with a dedicated team of dozens spread across the globe. But saying those things would be a slight, heck no, check that, it would be a massive, massive stretch. So how does a typical episode get constructed with content? Well, you know, this sounds basic, but first thing is I listen and read a lot of what is placed out there. I read on business and energy and culture and geopolitics and finance. And when I'm reading and listening and scrolling and browsing, it could be with newspapers or magazines or blogs or websites, radio, and so on. And sometimes, mind you, I'm doing so to pick out obvious instances of hypocrisy or inconsistency or inaccuracy to discuss. And these days, I think we all know there's plenty to choose from. Every week, a new score of potential material gets placed in the queue and in the bullpen, so to speak, for future use. So I'm not lacking for content in those arenas, unfortunately. Second, I'm always looking for themes that are consistent with the themes that I discuss in my book, Precipice. It's things like, of course, the importance of creators and enablers and servers or the doers of a society. How free markets, right, and capitalism, they provide more benefit to the human condition than any other form of government or organization of society in the history of mankind. How more and larger growing segments of our economy and our society are aligned against those doers and the free market, and how they're looking to appropriate and consume and tax the value created by the creators and the enablers and the servers. How many of the tactics that are utilized by those takers or the powerful leech class are effective by eroding and destroying the rights of the individual and the individual's ability to achieve for his or her own interests and benefit. And then, of course, looking for things like how the noble beauty of all men being created equal and the concept of equal rights and meritocracy, how they are out there and how they can be heightened with respect to awareness, but also coupling that with pointing out the insidious danger of things like equal outcomes. Precipice was written on these types of foundational themes, and the themes, they're more prevalent, pressing, and urgent than ever. Precipice has been out for over a year now, and it's a bit frightening to see how many of the warnings in the book have played out and come to fruition in the past 18 months. So then I take all these ideas or subjects in the pool and see how a few come together in an interesting thread or dots to connect or connections to make for an individual episode. And actually the process, I got to say, is quite fun. It's subjective as well. A lot of listeners tell me they love this episode or that one, but there's a wide range on the hit rate of each episode. Sometimes an episode resonates strongly with one person, and then the next week the new episode hits a chord with an entirely different type of listener. So that's my highly scientific process for creating each episode of The Far Middle. It feels good, seems to be working. So if it ain't broke, I don't plan on making any major fixes to it anytime soon. Now on to the next question, which is a closely related one to the prior question. And that is whether I plan on changing up the format of The Far Middle and get into something like video formats or guest appearances on each episode. And again, that's a good question. It's been on my mind for some time now. The short answer, I think, is a qualified yes, and I'm thinking along two lines. First, I'm thinking about running each episode on parallel video and audio-only formats. So this would get The Far Middle to the YouTube audience and more listeners. And if the objective of The Far Middle is to get people to engage and increase public discourse on big issues, which it is, then the dual track makes sense. And I've got a few cool concepts to try to hook interest as well, so stay tuned on that one as my thoughts unfold and turn into some action. And then the second line of thought for me on this item is the guest appearances. Now, what type of guests? Well, I'm not looking for the ones with the big names or the public personas, you know, to create some sort of shock value or PR value. I go back again to what The Far Middle is all about. It's raising awareness, engaging in public discourse, you know, elevating the doers that are out there. What I found the past few years is that there are dozens of awesome doers out there who are toiling every day, and they're not getting anything close to the attention and support that they deserve. So we can use The Far Middle to elevate their effort, their brand, and their identity. So both of these lines of thought for taking The Far Middle to the next level, hey, they excite me, and I hope it excites you. So stay tuned on both those fronts. Now, talking about excitement, people always get worked up about sort of investing in asset classes and where money's to be made and where money might be lost. One of the most common questions I get, I've got this probably over half a dozen times over the past year, which asset class across the economic portfolio do I have the most concern about looking out the next year or two? And, you know, that takes some thought because unfortunately there's a lot of different pieces of the portfolio when you look across asset classes that are facing some headwinds. But thinking it through, I think my single biggest area of concern sits with the commercial office real estate market, particularly in our large metropolitan downtown areas. And there's a lot of different reasons or root causes for this that are coming together. And I can walk through a few of those. But in total, it creates a really serious set of headwinds for that sector. I mean, first you had sort of the free money policies with zero interest rates or close to it that created the fuel, right, to create a significant overbuild, oversupply of commercial office real estate. So we're starting with a position where there's a significant amount of oversupply to begin with. Then you had pandemic hit and the government shutdowns that went with it. And when the shutdowns occurred, it did a couple of things. First, You know, it created a desire bordering on an insistence for a lot of workers in downtown areas to go remote permanently. So whether it's a significant downsizing in the square footage that's required by the business moving forward because of remote work, or whether it's just, you know, foregoing the office space altogether, that is working against reducing the number of tenants potentially in an office space versus growing them or holding them constant. The other thing that the government shutdowns did in the large cities is that it killed off a lot of the retail business, the service provider business that were servicing all those office workers in those large high-rises. So these could be restaurants, these could be dry cleaners, these could be retail that were basically in those ground floors of those major office buildings. And they've basically been either run out of business or many of them that are still left are facing some serious hardships, unfortunately, because their customer base has evaporated and the revenues that went with it. The costs of working in our downtown areas are much higher. They're going up, of course, because of inflation. The commute times are not fun. That's a major inefficiency and time sink. And there's a concern about physical safety because there's a crime problem across a lot of our cities, unfortunately. You couple all those things together, and then if you're a business that's looking to renew a lease or find a new home, or you're part of a team of that type of a business, what do? You've got another option, and that option is called the suburbs. And the suburbs are in many ways sort of in an advantaged position relative to the downtown areas across those different metrics we just discussed. And what you're going to see, I believe, is a cannibalization of tenants across these different commercial office real estate locations. You'll see the suburbs, as different businesses downsize or want to move, basically take tenants from or rip tenants away from the downtown locations. And then when the game of musical chairs stops, when the music stops, you're going to have buildings that are left with no tenants. Now, you see this in the data. So if you look at occupancy rates for office buildings in San Francisco and LA and downtown Chicago and Manhattan, in some instances, they're sitting way below 50% even today, you know, way past the shutdowns. And I can tell you, you know, in Pittsburgh, just driving into town from time to time, Monday through Friday during business hours, there is not nearly as much activity in the downtown areas as there once was in Pittsburgh. And I'm sure that's symptomatic and that reflects a lot of the situations in other cities as well. So whether it's companies that are going completely remote and no longer wanting leases when they come up, or they want to downsize their square footage, or they're asking for concessions on the dollar per square foot rate that they're receiving, or whether they're jumping ship and moving to the suburbs or to an entirely different setting altogether, I think that spells a lot of trouble in the coming years for the commercial office real estate market, particularly in the major metropolitan areas and the downtown areas. And I think the worst still lies ahead for that sector, unfortunately. Now, a popular topic on the far middle has been, and also in my book Precipice, have been central banks and the easy or free money monetary policies and the harm that they can do. An investment banker colleague asked me recently which central bank that I had the bigger problem with, the Federal Reserve in the United States or the ECB in Europe. Now, that's a great question because it's sort of like asking which is worse of two horrible options, something like, do you prefer death by drowning or do you prefer death by falling from some, you know, huge, great height? But I gave this question a go and objectively assessed the situation. And sitting here in the summer of 2022, I have to say that the ECB has done a worse job than the Fed. In fact, the ECB, it makes the Federal Reserve look like the most hawkish and prudent central bank in the history of central banks. And that's no easy feat since the Fed, since the 2008 financial crisis, has disgracefully destroyed value in vast swaths of our economy. But again, the ECB has done much worse. Look, everyone saw inflation coming. Everyone knew that modern monetary theory and free money, those were societal drugs that would destroy value and livelihoods and work ethic and the middle class. And yes, our Federal Reserve ignored all of it, it seems, forever, all to benefit Wall Street and the 1%, despite Janet Yellen at the time saying it was to help Main Street and the 99%, what gall. And yes, the Fed, our Fed, was late to the game. It was mugged by the data, had to be mugged by it. And then it got dragged along now as it raises rates and stops quantitative easing. And it starts at some point quantitative tightening to try to catch up to the out of control inflation. but it is the Fed is allowing itself to be drug along by the reality. And when compared to the inept ECB, allowing oneself to be drug along like the Fed is actually a much better situation. That's because the ECB has not only been asleep and in denial and incompetent, but the ECB has also been resistant and hostile to the facts and the realities of inflation and negative real interest rates. It won't even allow itself to be drug along by the real world. So consider the ECB set the absolute rates in negative territory for years, and it was sitting at an all-time record low of negative 0.5%. Now, the real rates are even worse, like maybe negative 10% if inflation is north of 9%, which it may be in Europe currently, that borders on the criminal. So a few weeks ago in late July, the ECB, it raises rates for the first time in 11 years, and it raises them to zero. Zero. Real rates in the EU are still massively negative, and recession is there even though the PhD economists won't officially recognize it yet. And bond yields of nations like Italy and Germany, they're starting to diverge. That means if rates go higher, as they probably must do, the future of the EU is in some serious jeopardy. The ECB pulled off an impressive feat of incompetence. It created free money policies, which created and fueled inflation. It then caused recession. They refused to raise rates, and then not raising them fast enough or significantly enough. Lagarde and the ECB, they insist that climate change is the biggest risk to markets and to the EU and to the human condition, but they're about to prove their own monetary policies were the much larger risk. Now that you've got my review of the ECB and how it's doing a not so great job, how about the next question that I receive, which relates to reviews, a different type of review? People always ask me about providing a concert or two review for shows that I recently attended. I don't attend as many concerts or sporting events as I used to. Too little time, too much hassle these days to deal with the logistics and the cost of doing so. But I did attend last month a show in Western Pennsylvania for two acts that I always wanted to see live. The main act was Chicago, and the opener I was even more excited about to see was Brian Wilson, of course, the genius behind the Beach Boys. So here is the review for what it's worth. And I'm going to start with a harsh reality. These entertainers, they're pushing 80, or in the case of Brian Wilson, he is 80 years old. And you look around at those fortunate to hit 80, and what do you see? You see that they've slowed down. They're not as sharp as they once were, and they've got physical ailments and disabilities. Now, we spoke in the past on the far middle about this with performers like Phil Collins and Bob Dylan, and now the same goes for Brian Wilson. So Wilson, along with many of his contemporaries, you know, they didn't take great care of themselves either, especially when it came to drugs and alcohol. Brian Wilson was rumored to have some vices with respect to the excessive use of LSD. And age plus all kinds of drugs, it leads to the current state that you see with Brian Wilson. He came out on a walker on stage. He sat at a piano, and the piano was sort of strategically placed along with other instruments to hide his hands and feet, because I suspect he might not have played a key or touched a foot pedal through different songs or through the performance. Now, he did sing some lines of a few songs, but the band with him was always looking to see when they needed to jump in and do lead vocals, which was for a lot of the set list, maybe 90% of the set list. But, you know, Brian Wilson, in my mind, one of the top five greatest musicians and songwriters in the history of American rock and roll. Pet Sounds, that album's a top five rock album of all time. Paul McCartney, he said it himself, he considers God Only Knows, the single off of Pet Sounds, to be the best song ever written. I think he's right. Wilson's band was awesome at the show. He had a founding member, Al Jardine, with him, which helped. He sang a lot of the songs. And he had Blondie Chapman. And this was the South African musician great who was with the Beach Boys for part of the 70s. He sings my favorite Beach Boys song of all time, Sail on Sailor. The set list that they picked for the concert that evening was awesome. Many of the hits that you'd want to hear or want to see them perform. And my favorite from the Brian Wilson opener, Heroes and Villains. I love that song. It was a pleasant surprise. And I think it's the most underrated Beach Boys song that's out there. God Only Knows was great. Sloop John B. Wouldn't It Be Nice? So that gave me my Pet Sounds feel. And Blondie Chapman, boy, he was a great guitarist. He killed it live, including, of course, his rendition of Sail on Sailor. And hey, just seeing Brian Wilson, even if we didn't hear much from him that evening, I saw the Beach Boys a few times live through the years, but never with Brian Wilson. It wasn't ideal, considering his condition, but I was glad he was there, and I'm glad that I was there. Now, Chicago, like I said, they were the headliner. Most people think of Chicago, and they associate the entire band's history with Peter Cetera and ballads. That was sort of during the David Foster era when he was the producer. But before that era of Chicago, the early efforts of the band, they were rock, jazz, blues, very experimental, I think very forward-thinking. They were incredibly talented. First 10 Chicago albums are very complex and varied. So when they came without Peter Cetera this past couple weeks ago, I was all over that. And they were great, particularly the horn section that they brought with them. And the set list was near perfect, stacked with a lot of that old stuff. Stuff like Dialogues 1 and 2, Old Days, and Make Me Smile. Those are some sort of highlights. And a review of the venue, by the way, which was an open amphitheater outside of Pittsburgh, sort of that cookie-cutter venue that sits outside a lot of major cities. Things were okay. The venue was not even half full, which for me was a plus, but it also shows two things. First, entertainment suffered blows from COVID shutdown policies and continues to suffer blows from inflation and recession risk. And second, the acts aren't the only ones pushing 80. So many of the fans who grew up with these bands, they're also pushing 80, and they often can't physically make it to the show. So we were way, way on the young end of the crowd spectrum that night. That's something I'm not used to these days. Now, concerts from aged acts and the attendance at them aren't the only things drying up. There's also the Colorado River and the Western United States, with what we were told is from things like climate change and endless drought. Someone asked me after they listened to a Far Middle episode a few weeks ago about the facts versus the fiction of the Himalayan snowmelt and the Ganges River flow. I'm not sure if you guys had a chance to listen to that episode or remember it. But then they pivoted and said, what do you think about the Colorado River and the drought in the Western United States? Are there any parallels? So it's a good topic. First, let's acknowledge the Western United States is susceptible to periods of drought and excessive rain or excessive flooding. It's always been the case, and it always will be the case. Second, the demand for water, it's way up due to the massive growth in the West the past 50 years, at least in certain urban areas or regions. But actually, the overall water demand is down in major parts of the West as use went from water-intensive agriculture to less water-intensive suburban homes. So I guess that there is a silver lining or some hidden benefits with respect to suburban sprawl. But as significant as these factors can end up being, there are other man-made factors that are driving water scarcity in the Western United States, and we can run through a few of them, maybe the biggest ones. And I think the single biggest factor is how water rights are assigned in the West to begin with. It's what is known as prior appropriation, and the doctrine is well known in the West, and it's virtually unknown in the East, where water is much more plentiful. And prior appropriation says that water rights get assigned to the earliest of settlers on a first-come basis. The only condition is that the water be used beneficially. Now, the problem with prior appropriation is that it creates a use-it-or-lose-it mentality. If you own the water rights and you find ways or you see ways to conserve or use less water, you run the risk of losing your water rights. So what is needed is a way to monetize those rights to incent trading of the rights, to incentivize conservation, and to help maximize the utilization of the water itself. I think the second biggest factor is that major water sources, like the Colorado River, they had apportioned volumes assigned to them to the different states, 7 total for the Colorado River, including California. And they did this apportionment at a time when the river flow was excessively high because it fell in a period of abnormal rainfall and wetness. Actually, to be precise, the Colorado River was apportioned in the wettest period in 500 years. So today, when things are drier than normal and droughts occurring, the river gets drawn down by the states to where it runs deficits, and the river itself in places like Lake Powell and reservoirs, they're running low all throughout the Western United States. And the regulators and the bureaucrats, they've got their hands, or maybe I should say their feet, in the water issue as well. Any transfer of water rights or uses, it's going to require regulatory approval and the okay from various stakeholders. Environmental regulations demand water be wasted in some instances instead of stored or collected. That makes drought more likely and worse, and all that creates risk and cost and time delays, meaning many transfers that make sense, they're never going to happen. So if you want to drastically improve the water situation in the Western United States, then move away from static, bureaucratic, obsolete models that we use today and move toward ones that make more sense. Use a free market approach. Revisit the Colorado River apportionment between the states to reflect current reality and flows. Allow water rights to be traded and monetized and to go toward their most optimal uses. Incentivize instead of penalizing conservation and incentivize more efficient water use under prior appropriation doctrine. And get the bureaucrat and the environmentalist out of the middle, whereby they stop rational decisions and moves and they simply serve the ideology to justify a job or whatnot. Now, will all these things and all these tactics and adjustments, are they going to cure drought in the Western United States? No, but it will make the Western area of the nation substantially more resilient to things like drought, and it will raise the levels at lakes and reservoirs in the West, and it will spur GDP growth. The Western United States in drought, those things make me think of heat. Heat reminds me of a great crime drama movie by that name with great actors. And that spurs thoughts of a line from one of those actors in Heat and another earlier movie that helped propel him to fame. So you ready for my delivery of that line? Here it goes. You talking to me? That's homage to a classic line by a great actor from the classic movie Taxi Driver. The actor, of course, is Robert De Niro. Today is De Niro's birthday. So happy birthday to an actor who delivered some of the greatest work ever in cinema. He's got a complicated legacy, perhaps, and he's become a bit of a polarizing figure of late. But in his prime, there were none better than De Niro. Which leads to the final question to address in this episode of The Far Middle. More than a few of you have asked me for my top 20 movies of all time, and as much as I would love to, I can't cover that here because of time. But maybe I will write a commentary essay on it sometime soon and place it on nickdeolius.com. Give me a little bit of time. I'd love to do something like that. But I can pick out one of those top 20 to wrap with here. My favorite role that De Niro is in, the often underlooked gem, The Deer Hunter. You had Robert De Niro, Meryl Streep, John Cazale, and Christopher Walken. Walken and Cazale were personal favorites. Cazale was only in five movies. All five movies that he was in before his untimely demise, he passed away at an early age because of a terminal illness. All five films were nominated or won the Best Picture Award. That story, The Deer Hunter, is a great one. It holds special meaning for me because much of it takes place in a Western Pennsylvania steel town. And the movie, I think, provides an accurate portrayal of that life in the late 60s in a steel town that you would find in Western Pennsylvania. So check it out if you love great movies, or revisit it if it's been a while. It's certainly in my top 20 movies of all time, The Deer Hunter. Now, it won't be a while till our next episode, which is number 66. You only need to wait a week, so make it a good week, and I will talk to you soon.